Barbarian Tribes of Rome, The Germanic Culture, War, Part 2. Now, wars in which all the able-bodied men of the tribe were engaged were not common until the beginning of the migrations early in the Iron Age. One such tribal movement was that of the Batarnae, who appear to have come into violent conflict with the Illyrians as they moved eastward along the Baltic. We are told by Georgians that the Goths arrived at the mouth of the Vistula under the leadership of kings, but we cannot be sure that these kings had the authority of later leaders such as Emaric or Theodoric. In later times, the campaigns of Theodoric, for instance, unitary command of the army was necessary to ensure cohesion and success in the full-scale battles that were waged. Such an army as that of Theodoric was not composed exclusively of Ostrogoths. It's known that the army led by Attila in the France was composed of contingents of many peoples, as also was the opposing army commanded by Aetius. These campaigns had got beyond the stage of tribal or folk wars. Generally speaking, however, the earlier migrations of the Vandals, the Longobards, the Burgundians, the Goths, and the West Germanic tribes were of the nature of tribal movements. The most mobile part of the tribe, packing up bag and baggage with women and children and moving in long trains of ox-drawn wagons, much in the same way as the covered wagon period in the early history of the western states of North America, but simply on a larger scale. At the first place of the leader, Herzog, or King, was at the head of the battle, the usual battle formation being the wedge. This was the most dangerous position, and sometimes when the leader fell, the whole organization was thrown in the confusion. In any case, after the initial attack, the wedge formation was very difficult to maintain, and often the battle became a series of fights between individuals or small groups of contestants. In the case of retreat or panic, it was clearly impossible for the leader to exercise proper authority over such a mass of struggling men. If the initial attack was not successful and retreat became necessary, it was usually every man for himself. We know that this was the case in the battle between Caesar and Aravistus, in spite of the fact that Aravistus had taken every precaution to make retreat difficult. Aravistus was forced to abandon the wagon train with all the supplies, the women and the children, which fell into the hands of the Romans. In one case, we are informed that the women of the Cimbri, after the battle, slew their children and committed suicide in order to avoid the fate of slavery. These were really tribal wars, but in later times it was no longer possible for the king himself to lead in front of the army. He had to control operations from a place of vantage. Germanic leaders had also learned, in some case at least, the advantage of having reserves, instead of throwing the whole weight of the army into the struggle at the beginning. It was because Caesar had reserves that he was able at critical moments to turn the tide in the battle against Aravistus. The general practice, however, seems to have been a wild, enthusiastic attack, with men shouting and noise, thrusting into the effect of the first shock to cause the enemy to give way. This often happened, but in other cases the strict discipline of the Roman army withstood the initial attack and was able to create confusion among the opponents by the solidarity of their line and the stubbornness of their resistance. The tribal armies of the Germanic people were mobile. They either took with them all their possessions, if on a migration move, or if the operation was a temporary one, they planned to live off the country, and so had no need for cumbersome supply trains, which the Romans found so necessary. We continually hear of the Roman anxiety about impedimenta, the risk of making an advance without assurance of sufficient food. The Germanic soldiers, however, did not seem to lay the same stress on this aspect of war. No doubt on occasions, suffering severely for want of proper provisions and supplies. Defended camps, in the Roman sense, do not appear to have been customary amongst the Germanic people in the pre-Roman Iron Age and in the early centuries of the post-Roman Age. We know that the Goths in southern France took possession of several key cities and defended them stubbornly. Although instances are known where the leaders had difficulty in restraining their men from opening the gates and rushing out to attack the enemy. The Germanic peoples had a strong disinclination to be shut up within walls of a city in wartime, especially those who lived some distance away from the cities of the limes of Roman Celtic nature. The fortification of a camp, which was to be occupied only for a short time, was definitely contrary to their custom and inclination. Digging of defensive trenches, the erection of a structural defense was such as customary in the Roman castra, required greater cohesion and greater discipline than the majority of the Germanic warriors were willing to adopt. The normal procedure for the Germanic folk armies on the move was to arrange ox wagons at night in a circle around the camp, just as it was done by the Western pioneers in the covered wagon days. And if there was a battle, the women and children remained there, anxiously awaiting the outcome, imploring the men not to allow them to be carried off into slavery. Nevertheless, fortified places were known. Several such forts, probably places of refuge for the non-fighting population, have been found and actually excavated. They are usually encampments of approximately circular nature with a trench and a double earth wall. Their village communities appear to have been undefended, and the only artificial defense of the tribal territory was to maintain a wide strip of wasteland between them and their neighbors. Military campaigns were timed to take place during the summer months, since campaigning in the winter under prevailing conditions was too difficult. Even the Romans, with all their organization, found winter campaigns arduous, and Caesar undertook them in Gaul only under extreme necessity. He continually reports preparations for going into winter quarters. Of course, when the Germanic armies were engaged in military operation in the southern land, there was no such climatic barrier to continuing the campaign during the winter, and it appears to have been done in just such countries as Italy and Spain. Just as every soldier was responsible for providing himself with weapons, he was also responsible for his own commissariat when at war. There is no doubt one reason why we hear so much about devastation of the enemy's country. If an army, even a relatively small one, must live off the country through which it's passing, one can readily understand that the writers of the chronicles of those days could speak bitterly of the destructive barbarians. Some of the devastation, of course, was planned to strike terror into the hearts of the population and lower their power of resistance or desire to attack. The customary procedure after battle, if successful, seems to have been to attend to the wounded and bury the dead of one's own side only, the enemy dead being left a prey to the birds, the beasts of prey, and some grimly described lines of such scenes occurring in ancient epics and sagas. It was during the Roman Iron Age that the Germanic armies became intimately acquainted with strongly fortified towns and cities. At first, as in the case of the Goths in the east, for instance, they had very little success against these fortifications and were usually forced to bypass the cities and devastate the countryside. Eventually, however, they learned from the Romans how to overcome the barriers of strong walls by undermining and thus causing them to collapse, by building towers on wheels from the top which the bridges could be thrown onto the walls, and also on occasion by bribing some of the inhabitants to open the gates. As a rule, they attempted to reduce such fortifications by blockade. This required patience and discipline, and the temper of the Germanic warrior was not always equal to this task. Booty belonged to the army as a whole and was divided among the troops, usually by casting lots. In certain cases, the total booty, including the prisoners, as happened after one of the battles with the Cimbri, were sacrificed to the god of war. So that's one part of the culture of the Germanic people. Now, next time we're going to look at how they could move so quickly in various time periods. Now, the source for this, The Germanic People, Their Origin, Expansion, and Culture by Owens, Civilization of the Celts by Launay, Civilization of the Steppes by Conrad. So I hope you enjoyed that. And as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment. Check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.